Josh Accardo, give me a name.
Tony Accardo.
Welcome to Give Me a Name, where a guest presents me, Ben Kirschenbaum, with a dead historical figure they find interesting, and we discuss. Al Capone got his nickname Scarface after a man slashed him with a knife because he thought Capone insulted his sister. Worth it for the cool nickname? Hard to say. All right, so this is officially the first episode where the guest shares the last name with the topic.
So, oh, I love being a first.
Yeah, of course.
I hope I nailed that part, by the way. I was really nervous. It was like an audition.
Yeah, no, but when
I
don't you know said,
I think I failed.
When you said that you were going with Tony Accardo, I was like, oh shit, did I not explain this correct? It's not like name a relative. Like, it's
No. That's funny you say that, because you're like, why is this guy naming his uncle? I'm sure his uncle's a fine man, but why would I want him to talk about him?
If I was a guest, it would just be Jim Kirschenbaum.
Supposed to be celebrities.
Yeah.
No, I definitely, when I talked to the bird about you and he brought up this show, I thought, oh, what a cool idea. And then when we got connected, I was like, oh, who would I even talk about?
Sure.
It's so hard to pick someone that everyone wouldn't already know a bunch of stories about.
Right.
And also that you could talk and talk and talk and talk to somebody else about them.
Absolutely.
It's a really hard thing to ask somebody.
Because the instinct is to go Abraham Lincoln or someone.
So mundane. Yeah. Too famous. Like Prince. Like, who doesn't know every story about Prince?
Right, yeah. Right.
Sorry, I know, I'm talking over it, but that's where my angst was. Now that it's out.
So, I got, just because it's the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
Same last name.
Yeah.
What is the, in terms of whatever you can say, the association. So, or I'll just say from the beginning, Tony Accardo, one of the most successful gangsters of all time.
Yeah.
Was the head of the Chicago outfit officially for about a decade, but then kind of a consigliere behind the scenes guy, sort of pulling the strings for, well, like 70 years.
He's the guy. Like, he's the final piece to every little puzzle you ever heard about the mafia. Yeah. So the reason why I picked him, beyond the points I mentioned, is that growing up, he died when I was about 11, and I just remember it being in the paper and being kind of a big thing, because he's not, he wasn't famous. Like, you know, Sam Giancana was famous or John Gotti was famous. He was from the old school, a Capone guy, and he just was not out in the news like that. So when his story was in the paper in San Diego, or I read it, I just remember stories coming up around then about how there was this guy, and the FBI would come to my great-grandparents' house and they would ask them, is this your brother? And my great-grandfather would always say no. And even my grandfather, when he died, he never said yes or no to any of that stuff. And it's a weird thing for me, because my great-grandfather, I'm Sicilian and Hawaiian, and the Sicilian side is very shut off because they came from another country. So it's kind of all tied in for me. So when you asked who, it's not really something I've ever talked about publicly, because it's just not a very fashionable thing. It doesn't look good if you're trying to imply that you're associated with murderers. But at the same time, there is a lot about my great-grandfather's life that is so similar to this man's life. Mm-hmm. I remember reading the book I referred you to, and it was just, why not talk about this and actually give it a go with somebody who's from the outside, and is just because you just looked him up after I told you who he was and went for it. And I thought, oh, what a cool way to actually have a conversation.
Yeah. And the book you recommended to me was written by this guy, Romer, who is, I guess,
FBI
one of the
guy.
Most,
yeah.
And I was looking up him. I mean, it seems like he's one of the most acclaimed FBI agents.
It's like J. Edgar Hoover, a couple other guys. And like, this dude's actually decorated. And that's why I referred that book, because I thought, he can only get away with so much as far as like embellishing or adding his own thing in there, because he's in the room and he has other agents reading this book. I thought, oh, this has to be pretty true. Because
right.
This guy can't, he's an FBI guy. He can't really lie.
While it is a nonfiction book, though, I recommend that book to anyone.
Oh yeah. I think that it's fascinating. If you're interested in organized crime at all, that book, and comparing it to what we have going on now in our world, the Patriot Act and all those different things that have stemmed from that, and what these guys were capable of getting away with It's insane. You could never do it now. It's over. There's no way.
And one thing that Romer constantly talks about is that, so Accardo is sort of a, what would you say, protege of Capone? Or
so I think probably Machine Gun McGurn. He's an Italian guy, but that's the name he took on. That's the guy that's the mentor of young Tony Accardo. So Tony Accardo, he is born in the USA.
But they were just off the boat.
Just off the boat. And my great-grandfather was born in Sicily and came over and is a similar age of Tony Accardo. They're very similar in age. And they look very similar. So I just remember that sticking out in the beginning of the book about how this guy is taken in by this other young man who's maybe like 4 or 5 years older than him or something like that, which gets associated with Capone. And then from that point forward, by being a little bit lucky, but ultimately being pretty savvy for a young guy, ends up in a position that's like the most unheard of thing in the history of crime.
Yeah. I mean, I said that Accardo is involved with organized crime for 70 years, and it's because obviously he got started super young.
Yeah.
So born in 1906 on the west side of Chicago, dad was a shoemaker, and he gets involved with a smaller gang called the Circus Cafe Gang, which it seems like...
Great name, right?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Such a great name.
And it doesn't seem like... It doesn't feel like a tough name, right?
It's maybe the dudes are so tough.
But they're amazingly tough that they don't need...
They don't need a tough name.
Yeah, they don't need to be like, you know, the Terminators or whatever. But he's like 14 when he drops out of school, which is a very common story for these sort of, you know, immigrants in New York and Chicago. And the gang is kind of like a... Almost like a farm team.
Yeah, yeah.
For
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. So Capone doesn't really start the Chicago mob. There were a few names that I saw. And the nice thing is that Romer at the back of the book gives like a nice appendix of
the
history of the Chicago mob.
Yes.
Which is just super easy to follow. And it's just like boom, boom, boom.
The thing that helped me out the most was when Romer even gives you a full-fledged, declassified FBI mafia branch from like, I think like the 30s and 40s and 50s. Of how all the bosses and families are broken up, and then especially when they became the commission.
Yeah.
And they all, it's basically the commission is essentially where Marriott buys up every little hotel they can and makes it a Marriott. It's just basically, we're going to own you.
Yeah.
And we're going to own you. We're going to become a conglomerate. And this is how we are represented. It's big business.
And I know it's like, obviously it's in the name, but it is organized. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
How it is a business. And it starts off as kind of more of a rough thing. There's Jim, I'm going to butcher all the pronunciations.
Yeah, they're hard ones.
Jim Colosimo.
Yeah.
I think was kind of in the early 20th century, the guy who's starting to organize things in Chicago. His sort of follower is a guy named Johnny Torrio.
Yeah. Torrio.
And Torrio is the one that gives Capone his start. And Capone, aka Scarface, actually kills Colosimo.
Yes.
And Torrio and Capone are the new real origins of the Chicago
Terrace
outfit.
Winter actually did a really good show, Boardwalk Empire, that kind of fictionalized, but gives you a basic rundown of that era of Prohibition.
Right.
Which to me is fascinating because it focuses on a young Capone, a young Lucky Luciano, like all these guys who end up being the Mount Rushmore, if you will, of the Americanized glorification of mafia.
What I didn't realize is that Capone may be the most famous gangster ever, or at least up there.
I mean, he's like in power for like 5 years or something. Yeah. It's something very minimal.
And he's so young too. Yeah. I think of him as De Niro in The Untouchables.
Yeah. Kind of old fat guy, looks like the Penguin.
He's like, but he's like in his 20s for all this stuff. And when he's actually finally put away for, again, tax evasion, like they don't get him for bootlegging.
It's the best.
And Romer has like a big thing about like how Elliot Ness is basically overrated.
Yeah, he goes in on him. He really does. He the whole Untouchable thing, he shits all over it.
And he's like, they got him on taxes. It was the nerds in the back.
Yeah, it was the bean counters that got Capone. It's like when Joe Montana, he did this fucking documentary where they bring up, he was on the team that carried Rudy. You know the movie Rudy, right?
Yeah.
So the movie has made Rudy into this like monster. Like Rudy's been to jail now for different scams and shit.
The real Rudy.
From the real Rudy.
Yeah.
And he goes, we did that because this dude was so annoying and so cheesy that when he got in the game, we lifted him up. If we would have known that they would have made this guy into a folk hero. We would have never carried that. Because I'm telling you right now, he looks right in the camera. Like, I would have never carried that guy off the field with the rest of the team if I had known he was going to be
so
a folk
funny.
Hero.
It's Montana saying
it's
that,
Joe
too.
Montana's
it's
a
Joe
great,
Montana famously,
there is
like,
no
emotionless.
More credible guy to yeah. say that. Yeah. Just shit, shit's right in your mouth.
So Ness, I guess that whole movie, I actually recently rewatched that movie, not having to do with this. And it's all right. I always found it to be a little overrated for those. It's not like the same level as the other famous
it's,
gangster
I think,
movies.
So who shot that again? It's like,
De Palma.
It's the way he lights, because he did Scarface and a couple other things. And I feel like ever since Gordon, whatever, the guy who shot Godfather, did everything so dark, and Godfather is such the piece of all pieces for, you know, course, mafia yeah. films. Of course, you're like, why is this so bright? Such a bright, it's almost like Dick Tracy bright, you know, it's bright. Yeah. And that always throws me off. It's a good movie, but that bat thing is true. Isn't that fucking crazy when Romer talks about that bat thing being
so
with the guy that Accardo is like was close with, right? Go ahead. I know you got the research.
No. It's just that no, I'm just so excited about it. Because in general, Romer's kind of shitting on the Hollywoodization of the Untouchables story.
Yeah.
But he is like, oh, you know when Robert De Niro beat the shit out of a guy with a bat? That actually kind of happened.
That's true. Yeah.
People in the Capone gang were sort of rebelling against him. And of course, Tony Accardo's nickname that everyone referred to him as was Joe Batters.
Yeah.
Which is a name that Capone gave to him. I like how Joe is not even related to Tony
at all. Yet. And that was the funniest part about that whole thing. Because when he sets that up and then you start reading the book all the way through and you're kind of underestimating how much he's called Joe, it's basically his name.
Yes.
They treat it as if his name is Joe. I don't think anyone in that book he says calls him Tony that's a close friend.
And they sometimes call him Joey.
Yeah, like JB. Yeah. I mean, they really, it's his name. There was no way anyone would think that wasn't his name.
And it's literally just because Al Capone one time was like, hey, this guy's a real Joe Batters over here.
It's like after he comes in, it's so funny how that era is so kind of like, come over here, kid. You know, like this guy just bashes two guys. The reason why he gets the nickname is because he beats two men to death with a bat, a baseball bat.
And that'll do it. That's going to give you a whole new name.
This kid's a real Joe Batters. Hey, I fucked my whole voice up doing that.
So, Prohibition, 1920 to 1933. And that is when the mob in general in New York and really in particular in Chicago becomes what it is. And just makes a shitload of money and fills in a vacuum that needed to be filled. And again, Capone put away in 1932, sort of has a really sad ending.
I mean, at least he gets to go to Florida.
Yeah.
He gets to go back to his home in Florida when his brain turns to mush.
Yeah, he had syphilis and like it went to his brain and died young. And
Yeah, I heard he died like shit in his pants and stuff too, which is no dignity for a guy like that. I mean, that's like a cruel joke.
And in the 20s, though, pre-syphilis, or well, maybe not pre-syphilis, but
it's probably floating around in there.
When in the 20s is when Accardo slowly works his way up. Super young guy, but he, and it seems like there was one kind of big event where Capone is, and maybe some of this is just like lore, but Capone's getting shot at outside the Hawthorne Hotel, and Accardo seems like he's almost like covers him, like almost like willing to
Yeah, that was when he was standing outside the suite door, right? Yeah, he was like, he became basically his driver and wheelman and bodyguard and all that. Yeah, I remember reading about that. I think what's interesting to like my tie-in with this era is that my great-grandfather changed his name when he came over from Ellis Island. He got in trouble in Sicily. He came over like 19 or 18, something like that.
Yeah.
And he came over and he changed his name to Sam. And then he actually ended up serving time for Prohibition.
Mm.
And a lot of years. So I think on and off, 10 years. At least he served in penitentiaries due to Prohibition stuff.
And was that more the bootlegging stuff?
The bootlegging.
Not like a tax evasion. So
he was bootlegging liquor. And I always kind of associate this era because Capone, as he's going in jail, he's in Leavenworth at one point during this era. And my great-grandfather had a story about getting a cigar from Capone. But no one knows the full details of why he would tell that story. I don't think he would tell it fully.
Right.
Because I don't think there's a I think the name, it's not just a coincidence. Those dudes aren't associating with one another unless there's some kind of...
Sure, yeah.
Even some kind of bridge. I'm not even saying that's blood relation or not, but Al Capone's not just handing a guy a cigar in prison and having a smoke with him. Not a random guy.
Yeah.
So it's just like all these little things. And when I'm reading this first part of the book,
right,
it was hard for me in the reread to do your show to not start piecing together some weird coincidences that I wish I could know. Part of me wishes, the other part likes it better as a mystery, but...
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, Tony Accardo's relationship with Capone never... I mean, you know, Capone's the guy...
I think it's like just employee-employer,
yeah,
you know, it
and
seems.
When Capone goes away, obviously there's a power vacuum. The first guy to take over is Frank Nitti, who is... tries to be sort of the anti-Capone in the sense of flashiness.
Yeah.
And Capone, I said, like, I mean, he's the most famous gangster to us. He was also the most famous gangster then. I mean, people knew who Al Capone was.
Oh, yeah. Gotti had anything on Capone. He was front page news, I think, every day.
Yeah, Gotti, I feel like, is an easy kind of comparison.
It
right?
is.
And Capone just lived a lavish life.
Oh, before we go further with Capone,
yeah,
how fascinating was it to you that Romer broke down the process of elimination to essentially confirm without extreme proof that Tony Accardo was one of the gunmen in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre? Wasn't that, I mean, the way he pieced that together, you're like, well, I have to, this is the logic. I can't break this dude's logic right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, I didn't even fully realize, because you see the movies and you're like, oh, okay, maybe it's exaggerated or whatever, but... over 1,000 gangland killings in the 20s.
I mean, that's insane. When I read that,
non-stop.
They just overrun the whole city.
Possibly the most famous, 1929, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre on Valentine's Day. And, Capone is just kind of, for years, trying to get full control of Chicago. He's fighting against the Northside Gang, which I think is largely Irish. Not totally Irish, but largely Irish.
Like the people who were there before he got there.
Right.
Whoever that crew ended up being,
And... the main guy that they kill in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre is this guy, Bugs Moran. But two guys dress up as cops, and it was kind of like this elaborate plan.
Yeah,
It really is great for a movie.
I mean, it's that era, and then the way they pull up and all that stuff, and the way they are dressed as cops, and they figure out, like, because it's all kind of done, because they don't have technology, and they don't have access to sewing machines and shit.
Right.
So it's a really high-end caper.
Yeah.
For that era, even though to us it looks kind of like clowny and gauche and like, oh, that's kind of like silly.
Yeah.
You know, these guys pull up in those dopey cop uniforms, but they're committing heinous acts. I mean, they're like decimating dudes with Tommy guns. They cleared out that guy's whole gang. I mean, I think the main guy got away, or he wasn't there. He had just left, and then they thought he had come back or something, if I remember the story right. I know for a fact the main guy they were going for did not get killed in St., but he got his crew just chopped.
Yeah.
So he just had no more stake in the whole territory after that.
Yeah, so Accardo, like you're saying, is like front and center for these epic, famous killings.
Yeah, and that's his deal. That's his like thing for a long time, too, is they send him in to do stuff that's not...
Yeah, no, I mean, the guy...
fun stuff.
A lot of blood on his hands. At least... well, I was about to say at least in the beginning of his career, but then at the end of his career, he also...
super savvy guy. Yeah. The minute he doesn't have to do that anymore, it's like, he's gone. Like, he is gone.
So Nitti takes over. Nitti's in power for a little while, although there's... so one of the main guys to associate with Accardo is a guy named Paul Rica, and they seem to be sort of partners
for
years. So some people say that even when Nitti's in control, Rica's kind of pulling the strings a little bit. One of the things that... post-prohibition, there's a question, how are we going to make our money? I mean, there's gambling is a huge
girls.
Thing, obviously. And one of the things is labor racketeering, which is, I guess, one of the most famous, associations.
Well, didn't you like how they literally, we talked about this up front about how it really is organized. I mean, we're talking organized. When Roma was breaking down parts of the business, like, this guy's job is to basically be what the government calls a lobbyist when it's legal. This guy's supposed to go get judges and senators and anyone that could, union heads in the pocket.
Yeah.
And if that dude can't do it, he sends in a guy that's going to crack somebody's fucking head to make sure it happens. I mean, it's a well-oiled machine of corruption.
And yeah, I mean, in terms of
politics, it's what the government does to us, but it's legal. You know, you're not going to get cracked over the head. But I mean, have you ever had to pay the government $7,000 for road gigs? I've had. It's not fun. I have. It's not fun.
Yeah. No,
I have my knees, sure, but am I eating tomorrow? I don't know.
Well, and if you do on the road, I mean, it's going to be maybe a Denny's. I mean, like, it's
if not, I'm lucky, yeah, I'll get a Denny's.
Denny's is lucky. Worst case,
a Stu Evans or whatever. What's it, Stewart? Bob Evans. Sorry, not Stu. Stu Leonard's Bob Evans.
Got it.
Bob Evans is a lower or like a regional Denny's, if you will. It's not nationwide.
Yeah.
It's good shit, though.
It's on the rise. See a Bob,
I buy stock in Bob Evans. Take it from me. The guy who can barely afford to eat.
You heard it here first. With labor racketeering, one of the businesses that they get into heavily is Hollywood. And that actually, there's a Hollywood extortion case in the early 40s, and that's where where the authorities actually start to get these big guys.
Yeah.
And Nitti, who's already been to jail.
This is before RICO predicates. This is before government turn witness. You know, it's the golden age, as these dudes would call it, of that era of organized crime. It's the golden age.
And one thing that Romer always points out is that J. Edgar Hoover, who we usually think of as like not really following the rule or not really giving a shit about the rules.
Yeah.
He doesn't go after the mob for a long time.
I feel like he, now that we know what we know, and it's so many years removed, but it's like, how do I word this? It's one of those things where how is he not a guy who you know just from his actions after the fact is that anal and that insane and willing to sink any ship by any means necessary, all of a sudden he's not going to take an interest.
He has the excuse is that he didn't know, or the FBI had no information that the mafia was interstate. They thought it was like local to particular cities or whatever.
Oh, okay. Of course, so some red tape involved that he couldn't connect the dots.
But it's also technicality.
It's a technicality
that you don't. Yeah,
it's like travel in the NBA. It's like as long as you don't take seven steps, we're gonna just go with that. You knew you were traveling, but
absolutely. So Hoover, that's his kind of excuse. Eventually, in the 50s. There is Appalachian.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's this
that
big
meeting, yeah.
So there's this big meeting of basically there's chaos going on in New York and in New York City. And there is a meeting with the top brass of like every big city. And this is 1957. And basically it gets busted by just the New York State Police. Appalachian is some, you know, nothing town in the middle of New York.
Yeah, it was picked that way for, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, specifically. Exactly.
And so the police is like, why are there so many Rolls Royces?
Yeah. That was the best part of it. Like every fucking Cadillac and Rolls Royce that ever existed on the East Coast ends up in fucking Appalachian.
So that's finally the turning point where J. Edgar Hoover's got to be like, okay, we got to go. This is clearly organized throughout the country.
Yeah. So that the great part about this is the five families. And when he breaks down the five families and how they're distributed regionally.
Yeah.
I found that to be fascinating because I, you know, grew up in San Diego. And I remember being an Italian kid and hearing about all this stuff. And you watch the movies and you're thinking, oh, is that my heritage, my culture? But you never hear about, oh, the San Diego family. Like, there's, you know, it's all part of a bigger beast, you know?
And Chicago, and Accardo's a big part of this.
Yeah.
Everything to the west of Chicago is Chicago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Basically, they own it all. It was theirs. Yeah.
Including Vegas, eventually. I mean, yes. I guess New Yorkers sort of started.
There's a lot of, I think if we, don't quote me necessarily, but I remember reading things, and I feel like now with The Godfather being so, like, almost 60 years old or whatever, they use some stuff from Tony Accardo's life in the book The Godfather.
Okay.
I feel like Puzo used bits and pieces of different stuff. Like the whole, like Tony Accardo during this time period, he's never been to jail. He's been fingerprinted, but he's never spent a night in jail, according to him.
Which is insane.
Insane, especially as a young, you know, thug growing up, doing a lot of bad shit. And there's this great story in the book where he's so powerful, they get him on something on a Friday. And he's about to have to spend the full weekend in jail. and he uses his phone call in memory of a fucking judge, I guess, he owns.
Right.
And this, I guess the judge, and Romer says he knows the judge and who this judge is at some, like, I think he's at a, like a disco party or a costume party.
Yeah.
And this guy has to drop everything.
That story is amazing.
Because Tony's like, get the fuck out of your party and fucking come get me.
I'm not breaking my streak.
Yeah, I'm just not basically one night. No, no. And he's out. He's out in an hour.
Tony Ricardo dies when he's 86 years old.
Natural causes.
Natural causes. Never been to jail.
Never went to jail.
Arrested, sure, but never actually slept the night in jail, which is like, I mean, I don't know enough about the history of the mafia to like know whether that's totally unprecedented, but it's gotta be.
I mean, he has to be like on that list of like Tom Brady. He's just the goat.
He's Montana.
He's the goat.
Yeah, he is the Montana.
He's undeniable. You can't deny that guy. You know, everybody goes to prison at some point or gets caught doing something. And for that guy to be that untouchable for that long and be involved to the day he dies, he's not just a guy that was like passive. You know, he's getting information where he makes a decision, he sways oceans. He sways.
The other thing that I'll say is that, so Accardo, basically, just to go back to that Hollywood extortion thing, so Nitti actually kills himself. He shoots himself
wild,
at the train tracks.
Right?
And a big reason for that is that he didn't want to go back to jail because he was really claustrophobic. And it seemed like they were going to, that he was going to go
forever. Yeah. I remember. Okay. Yeah, that's
Rica
right.
Rica briefly takes over, but then he's also in on the extortion case. That's how Accardo officially becomes the.
A lot of guys went away. I mean, it was like he was fifth in line 1 minute, and then he woke up the next morning and he's like the starter.
But here's my favorite thing. So he does a million things during his 10 years as the official boss that, you know, just greatly improves the status of the outfit. I mean, just like. Getting more involved in gambling, well, in Vegas, taking things over, in Cuba, all sorts of things where just the money is just...
Godfather 2. I mean, they really took a lot from what this guy did because he's in control around the same time that Michael Corleone's in control. It's like the 50s before Cuba basically has a revolution. So everyone's doing a lot of business out of Cuba. And then it's just like a natural place from Florida to Cuba to smuggle goods. I mean... It's open season. It's Wild West.
The other cool thing that I thought was kind of, we make the Brady sort of Montana comparison. There's also a bit of a George Washington thing. He willingly gives up power. Like, I've never heard of it, that he's like, he's the boss and he's like, I'm going to step down. And obviously a lot of it's probably because like the IRS is on his ass.
Sure.
And,
but
he gives it to Sam Giancana and he's like, I'm going to step down. I've done my terms.
But what a genius though. Okay. We're getting into that thing. You and I were talking about this before we got on, but how Romer, I mean, basically this William F. Romer guy was on stakeouts, listened to obscene amount of hours of audio tape on Tony Accardo. This guy knew Tony Accardo probably better than most of Accardo's best friends because of the fact he was under surveillance for 15 years under this guy.
Yeah, and we got, and but there for at least some period, there are bugs like, you know, all over the place.
Everywhere. And the fact that this FBI guy, a sworn enemy of organized crime, says like, I've never seen this person be unkind. I've never seen them be unfair. Every time I've dealt with him, he was a class act. I mean, the whole book, he has to keep apologizing for being honest about how he really admired and respected this other person.
Doesn't get into drugs. That was one of the things that he keeps complimenting him on. And sure, maybe he doesn't get into drugs because then the mafia looks more like bad guys and like that'll draw more attention, whatever the reason is. But he's complimentary to that. That's also a Godfather thing,
yeah.
Right?
They base a lot of his tendencies and how he acts. You'll notice, like, this guy's never had a mistress.
Yep.
It's like family Michael man. Corleone. I mean, never has a mistress, never, like, not a big drinker. I mean, just, like, everything you would want somebody to be if they married your sister or daughter.
Sure.
If you didn't know about that guy, you're like, I mean, if I didn't know that guy could be a stone-cold killer at a drop of a hat, that's the kind of dude you want in your life. You're like, I admire this guy.
And fascinating with the family, too, his descendants.
Oh, yeah.
Tons of football players going back.
Oh, it's insane how his bloodline through his daughter. I mean, now the Bosa, you have the Bosa guys. And the I think the main dude, there's like two of them, right? The wife married a guy who's the boss's dad.
Right.
There's another guy, Crimeo.
Yeah.
That's the grandson, and he was an animal. That guy was like unbelievable. And he has a son, I think. It's just a big family of football players.
But it's so interesting when Romer talks about, and I listened to a couple podcasts too, where they're all just talking about how this guy was, I mean, I think that there's a certain level of just like, we respect people that are good at what at their job.
Yeah.
He's just really good at his job.
Seriously. He's really good at his job.
And you also can contrast him with a guy like Giancana who takes over after him. And Giancana was like kind of going back to Capone, like super flashy. He was dating one of the McGuire sisters, this famous singer.
Yeah, it's all that JFK shit's during that time too. I mean, Hoffa's during that time. Robert F. Kennedy. I mean, it's just like that whole like 15 years.
They hated Robert Kennedy.
Oh, my. I mean, talk about a side talking motherfucker, though. I mean, I cannot believe now you like see what Joe Kennedy put together and all the dealings he had with all these different mafia guys.
Sure.
Apparently, the bad guys, right? This guy's doing open business with his bootlegging business with these other people. Gets his son elected using mafia guys, and then to diss Sinatra. I mean, and then to do the shit that Robert did. I mean, that's ballsy, man.
Yeah.
To think like, oh, I'm an Irishman and I'm better than these dirty Italians. Like, that's how we see it.
Sure.
Is like that. I get that I'm very far removed, generations removed from that, but just growing up with my grandfather, it's like, that's how we felt.
Yeah.
You know, and these dirtbags.
Yeah. The mixing of like different races with this stuff is also so interesting, especially in the early years, because so the very first episode of this podcast was on Meyer Lansky, who was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this element of, I mean, Jews, Italians, Irish, I guess those would be the big three. I mean, there's other, but like,
yeah.
And it's kind of this, well, first it's just Sicilian. Like, it's even
well, that's my grandfather is just Sicilian. He is nothing else.
So it's even controversial in the early years to bring in Italians from outside of Sicily.
Yes.
And then the sort of mixing with Jewish gangsters with Irish gangsters and the rivalries there is just so interesting as time goes on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I feel like Italians and Jewish people got on pretty well.
Yeah, that worked. That ended up being mutually beneficial.
Like, those guys figured it out.
And speaking of which, okay, so fast forwarding to towards the end, or not really, the guy lives so long.
Yeah, he's so old.
To the late 70s, Accardo's house gets burglarized.
Oh, this is a great story.
And this is actually how Romer's book opens.
Yeah.
Because it's just sort of a good illustrative story of who he was. So there was a Jewish jeweler, guy who owned a jewelry store, that his jewelry store gets burglarized. And the jeweler has an association with Accardo and is just basically like, hey, like, can you help me out here?
He wants the inventory back.
He just wants it back.
Because his whole Christmas is ruined. He's devastated for a whole year. He's in the poorhouse if he doesn't get it back. Yeah.
So Accardo is able to, I think somewhat quickly, find out who did it. And sure enough, they give back all the jewels. Then, though, the people that did the burglary are pissed off at Accardo and they have the, I don't know if you want to say balls.
Oh,
or
that's the dumbest.
Dumb.
Whoa, who are you? What an idiot.
Just so stupid. It's so dumb.
Talk about a death wish. Just blow your head off. Why would you do this?
So they burglarize Accardo's house in Illinois while, I mean, at this point, Accardo lives like largely in
Palm Springs.
So, okay, so now like what happens, what you think is going to happen totally happens. And I mean, they die, they're killed. The people who actually did the burglary are killed. Anyone like
who rented the van to them got killed. I mean, they went down in the lesson line.
Yeah. And that's, again, how Romer's book opens up, because it's like I think it's almost a reminder that I'm going to say some complimentary stuff about this guy.
But
at the end of the day, he was a ruthless dude.
Yeah. I always love how he, you know, is so savvy. But yet when he goes to Atlantic City for the first time with Capone to be a bodyguard, he gets a tattoo.
Right.
He gets that, it's a on his trigger finger, it's a bluebird or something tattoo. And I always found that like Romer brings it up a lot, his tattoo, because he's so savvy and it's like, why would he get something that he could be identified by, like with? Like, you could know that guy did that, the guy had a bluebird tattoo. So it's always funny how the dude just like, there's always something, like one little thing, like funny how he would do that.
Yeah.
But he would play it so safe everywhere else.
The only other thing I can think of like that is that at one point he does buy a big house.
Yes.
Which is very unlike him.
Yeah. He went a little flashy, family, like big, but that place.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, Have you seen the photos?
He's a millionaire. He's so rich.
I wonder how much money he actually cleared.
I mean,
and with inflation, what that would be today.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
because like Escobar money, I mean, you're talking 70 years where you're getting a piece of everything still. He's getting a taste. He may not be getting boss money, but he's getting a taste for 70 years.
Yeah. Romer talks about the street tax, right?
Yeah.
Where it's just like any crime, any little thing going on in Chicago, he gets a cut of everything.
He gets a taste.
And sets up in Vegas, you know, obviously a big moneymaker, but he also puts in his slot machines.
Mm-hmm.
Little clever things.
Nuances. The guy's a nuance guy.
Yeah.
It's like a famous quote. I don't know. I can't really tell you who did it. But there's like a mob guy on record going, you know, Tony Carter had more brains for breakfast than Capone did his whole life. Like just...
Yeah.
It's just like a really savvy business person with organized crime. I mean, it's just... He's a great CEO. He's a fantastic CEO.
Which is also like you mix it with the fact that the way that he made his name was all brawn. You know, it was not brains at all. It was just like he just beat the shit. He just killed people.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah. He was just reliable.
Yeah.
It's weird because I'm doing my best on your show to not be so biased because I've lived a long life with this person being like knowing a lot about this person. But it's like one of those things where I don't condone killing anyone. I have a son. I don't want him to kill anyone. I don't want him to have to ever do that.
Sure.
I don't think necessarily people should be killing each other. I do think there are moments in life where you're a part of something like a war or what you perceive to be a willingness of two groups of people to fight, and you know it's going to go that way. And I feel like it's a whole other discussion people need to have. So my point being is that when you hear someone can be ruthless and all those things, you have to think by their actions and how he was so calculated and also very caring for his family and his wife and all these things. And that's not something you can really fake long term. If someone's watching you like the FBI for 50 years, I'm sure they'd find a tape where you're calling your wife a cunt. And that never came up. So I'm just going to go on a limb here and say this dude's really good at accepting his realities. And I just think that, you know, being that I know my great grandfather from all the stories I've heard, is a great man. And I would never want anyone to think that he was a less of a man or a violent man because he served 10 years in federal penitentiary.
Did you know what I mean?
I met him when I was a baby.
Right.
My mom and dad had me at like 18, so he was still alive.
Oh, okay.
But there's a lot of weird things I've heard about my great-grandfather that are like, he didn't like San Diego, looked too much like Sicily. All of a sudden, he gets out of prison the last time, and he wants my grandfather to teach him English. He can't read or write. But he ends up becoming like the head of the sanitation department in Flint, Michigan. It's just like a lot of weird stuff about him where you're going, how are you getting some opportunities like that if you can't read or write and you can't really speak English?
Yeah.
And you have a prison record. How does that happen? How do you become a foreman? You know, like, and you're just starting, you know, why are the FBI showing up to the house so much kind of thing where, I don't know. That's kind of where I'm at. This book brought up a lot of that.
But also in terms of like, you know, just talking about the morality of it and stuff like that, there's always the thing of, do people in this world just kill their own? You know, when the violence happens.
Yeah.
Or is it on the outside? And Accardo, I mean, I don't know the whole record or whatever, but Accardo, at least because he's sort of, maybe again, it goes back to this idea that we want to stay low key. Mm-hmm. He's a big, we're in this internal thing. Like when there's violence, it's insular.
It's an expense to him.
Yeah.
You know, that really is something that they talk about in the book. He looks at blood as a huge expense, not to rip off The Godfather, but he really does use that terminology.
A last resort,
You know, it's a last resort situation. Yeah. And I, like you said, am I going to fault, like I have a buddy who's a war hero. I've never asked him directly, but I'm going to go on a limb and say he's probably shot some guys point blank in the face.
Yeah.
And do I think that guy shouldn't be allowed to have a family or he's an evil person? No. I mean, I've come from a place where like they ask me, you know, when you have like an anger management thing like I've had in the past, they ask you about your upbringing, right? And that shit, you can't hide if you have that kind of evil sociopathic shit, like stabbing puppies and shit like that. You can't hide that. There's only so much you can do to mask that kind of stuff. you start making mistakes because it's more of a reaction on how you deal with life. If you can't truly, I'm not making it about an emotional thing, but if there's nothing on record with this guy's like ripping people's fingers off with pliers and all this kind of sadistic shit, I would find it hard to believe that the murderous part of him carries over into anywhere else but what is necessary for the business.
Yeah, that's definitely the impression that I got reading the Romer thing. And again, it's like Romer's an FBI agent. This is his enemy. You know,
yes.
At least on paper, it's his enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real reason for him to lie. Like,
plus they hate those cops and gangsters are the same people turned inside out. They live by these weird codes, like pride codes. If he's in there talking up some guy that the other guys didn't at least back him on, he would not be allowed to write that book. That he would not be allowed to do his speaking events that paid him a lot of money to do so. He would not be allowed to use that he was a former FBI agent. He has to go through so many channels and then a blood level of respect with his other brethren to write that book. So
yeah,
for me, that's the biggest thing.
And one symbol of the respect is that, which he discusses, is that they stay away from each other's families.
Yes.
There are these codes, even between the FBI agent and Accardo.
Yeah, because it's a game. It was supposed to be a chess game, and the reason why gangsters got off on it is because I'm going to see if I could beat you at chess.
Right.
And then it just got to be a point where cartels are whacking people's wives and cutting the kid's head off. I mean, then it gets to that point, and you're like, well, now you've ruined it.
God, come on.
This had nuance to it.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, that was so much fun, man. I got to talk to you for 5 hours about that. What a great topic, man.
All right. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Anything to plug?
Yes. So you can follow me at Josh Accardo and go to joshaccardo.com for tour dates. I'm going to have a podcast launching soon. That's all going to be there whenever you hear this. So look at it.
Yeah, and excited for the podcast.
I can't wait to talk about it.
Do you mind describing it?
Yeah, it's called Working Class Holes. It's me and another comedian that grew up a little bit older than me, but 80s, 90s, and that working class, lower income background. I kind of, you know, both him and I do okay now. So we just talk about how we had all these bad jobs and then we compare them to our bad comedy jobs. So in every episode, you're going to hear about a bad job story and a bad gig story. And it just makes for, well, Ben knows, a lot of crazy shit happens with the bad gig stories.
I'll be in Fargo, North Dakota this
nice,
weekend.
Dude.
So here we go. All right, man. Thanks again.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.